ancestors were Ulster Scots who came over to this country about 1820, settled between Kingston and Gananoque on the St. Lawrence. My grandfather and great-grandfather influenced, I suppose, by writings of Grant and others, and the fact that a great-uncle had been one of the original members of the Northwest Mounted Police and had gone to the Western Territories in 1774, was greatly impressed by what he saw there. At any rate, my grandfather and great-grandfather left Ontario in 1880 and went out to Winnipeg.
What means,
Pastor? Oh, in 1880 there was steel through. They landed in St. Boniface, I think, and in Point Douglas, which was one of the two places to live, I guess. If you didn't live on the Hudson Bay Reserve, you lived in Point Douglas. I was born on Cathedral Avenue down in interesting house which my father built, but this was on the old Matheson homestead. The property is the one on which the famous John Black tree stands, or stood. I think it's still, I saw it still there.
Hmm?
57 Cathedral Avenue, yes. At any rate, as a small boy, I used to scramble up and down that that old Manitoba maple, which was a pretty striking feature of the landscape. I went to school in Luxton School first, and during the years of the First World War for a while at Norquay, because we were living with my maternal grandfather, the Brown of Brown and Rutherford Mill, Sonny Brune, and we lived in the mill yard there. And then to St. John's Technical High School, and then the University of Manitoba, where I graduated in medicine in 1930. You asked about the reasons for enlistment. It's really rather strange, because in the very early 30s, 1933, I was a young, struggling, practicing pediatrician in Winnipeg, and a new district medical officer arrived in Winnipeg, and that time, and he turned out to be a member of my fraternity, Hugh Cameron, now dead. But the militia was in very parlous straits at that time. Nobody really was much interested in the militia. And, of course, it was Colonel Cameron's job to stir it up. So he called on his fraternity brothers to give him a hand. And it looked pretty glamorous, you know. You got all dressed up in mess kits and whatnot, and you went to the military balls, and it looked pretty gay. Unfortunately, I guess I got interested in the techniques of soldiering. I joined the militia to be a chocolate soldier to start with. But I got interested in the techniques, and I took a number of qualification courses, and finally found I was qualified by examination to be a major, which was.
Did you take any of these courses away from anything, or did you all?
They were all at Fort Osborne Bags. Yes, in those days there wasn't any money for the militia. You couldn't go away very far, and of course the camps at Shiloh, the summer camps, and so on. At any rate, I was attached first of all as medical officer to the 10th Machine Gun Battalion, and this is a very interesting group. And I qualified as a machine gunner, which was part of the trick, since I had to be out in the ranges anyway where they were firing for medical reasons. Took this on.
What machine gun were you trained on? What was it?
Vickers.
Is that a water-cooled machine?
Yes, water-cooled gun. Beautiful weapon when it didn't jam. As a matter of fact, it turned out very usefully in Hong Kong many years later, because it was a beautiful weapon for that kind of warfare. And we had them. The middle six who were with us in Hong Kong were a Vickers regiment, Vickers battalion. The 10th Machine Gun Battalion eventually was, about 36 or so, 37, was amalgamated with the Winnipeg Grenadiers, which became, it had been an infantry regiment at that time, was turned to a machine gun battalion. And they were the Winnipeg Grenadiers MG, which was... So this opened up a new group in the militia. I was sent over with them as a medical officer. Still in the militia, still weekend soldiering. Interestingly enough, you see over there a beer stein. That is one of two, I think, that are in existence. Those were the steins we had in the officers' mess, first of all from the machine gun battalion. The machine gun crest is on the other side. When we joined the Grenadiers, the officers welcoming us in of the Grenadiers had a grenade put on the opposite side. We all had them, but they were all, we took them when we went down to Jamaica later on. We took them with us, and coming back, they came up as regimental stores. And for some reason or another, I and one other officer took ours home with us and left them there, didn't send them over. And of course, subsequently, all the others were lost in Hong Kong, and I think that my mug and Bob Phillips' mug are the only two that are left, which is a very interesting thing. Well, anyway, we went along very happily with the militia until the end of August of 39, when things began to look pretty dicey. And sure enough, on the 1st of September, we were at war. And the Grenadiers were mobilized as the one of the first battalions in Winnipeg. And, of course, nobody really had to go, but you had to live with yourself. And I had been a militiaman for a long time, and I liked it, and... As I say, you had to live with yourself, so if we were going to war, we were going to war. And that's how I came to it. Lest you see it. Just as simple as that. And indeed, I never regretted it. It's been a very, very interesting experience. Those early days of mobilization, very interesting. We got a lot of odd people in the Grenadiers, all fine fellows, but some with very funny backgrounds when we were recruiting. Our commanding officer at that time, Orville Kay, had been the crown attorney, I guess, in Manitoba, and he had prosecuted a lot of petty criminals. And as they got sprung from the jails and Stony Mountain and so on, there wasn't any job. You remember, this was in there, you won't remember, but it was in the depths of the Depression, and these fellows decided they'd join the Army. And being pretty smart operators, a lot of them felt that they'd like to be right under the muzzle of the gun. And if Orville Kay was commanding this, that was the regiment they were going to belong to. So that, you know, they came in, and we had, and many of them turned out to be extremely fine soldiers. When the crunch came, they were excellent. They weren't a hell of a lot of use as soldiers in peacetime. While we were mobilizing, we had a lot of trouble. We had crime sheets as long as your arm, orderly rooms. But they were just mischievous, mainly, these chaps. I got began to love them at that time because they were, you know, such rascals, some of them. And they'd try all the dodges to get out of parades and so on. And they thought I might be a soft touch, and I wasn't. And I think, you know, we developed a mutual respect for one another at that time. In May, I guess it was, the following year, we were warned for duty, and the rumor got around somehow or another that we were going to Norway. At this time, Norway was on the hob, and we were all issued heavy underwear and so on and so on and so on along. You know, along with the rest of our issue. But we were also outfitted in khaki drill, and in May we took off for overseas somewhere. We sailed from Halifax and went south and landed up in Jamaica, dropping a company off in Bahamas, and the rest was going to Jamaica. We were there a year and a half, and this was a very pleasant experience. One of the gongs you see up there is for the defense of Britain, and a lot of poor characters got this same medal for getting shot out of the air in the Battle of Britain and really getting punched around. I got mine for swimming in the Myrtle Bank pool in Jamaica. You know, it's hardly fair, but there it is. I think Jamaica was a very good experience for me in that it really taught me something about regular soldiering. Up until now, you know, this has been quite off the cuff. But my boss in Jamaica was a British RAMC lieutenant colonel, very dour Scotsman he was. Who? His name was Rob, Sandy Rob. And he lived by the book. He had soldiered all over the world, in Pekin and India and so on. Very proper, regular army officer who lived by the book, and the regulations for the medical services, Regs MS, British publication, was his Bible. And he used to throw this at me every now and again, you know. And you see, I had the Canadian troops down there, and I felt I was responsible for them. Indeed, we were the only effective troops on the island. The others, the British garrison, had gone to the Netherlands, West Indies. But I didn't have really an authority that I could throw against Regs MS. When Sandy Robb and I would disagree about what was to be done, he had the book. So I proceeded to write a book, a fictitious one, of course. And when Colonel Robb would tell me that something was to be done, and I didn't think it should be done that way, I would tell him, well, of course, and I'd quote him, my authority, which didn't exist. But he was quite impressed by this. I learned, however, after some terrible errors, that Sandy Robb was usually right, and that this book of his had been developed over many, many years of trial and error. And other people had made the same mistakes that I was making. So I learned Regs MS, and I learned it from cover to cover, and he couldn't tell me anything in the book that I didn't know. I recall one time, in this connection, he had told me about taking over a hospital someplace or another in the world, and Regs MS demanded an incoming inventory and an outgoing inventory. He had taken this over and found that he was stuck for payment for the door keys, which were missing in this hospital. Keys weren't on the inventory boards. They were in the book, but they weren't on the inventory boards in the ward. He missed them. He had to pay for them. And cost him £3.07 or something like that. And he, being a Scot, this hurt, you know, and he didn't like it a bit. And he told me this. We became great friends. And it's over a drink, I guess, sometime. Well, in the course of some time, we decided that I would take over the little building as a hospital up in Newcastle, which was the hot weather station in Jamaica. And so I did, and I went through with my sergeant major and his sergeant major. And Rob and I accompanying them. And finally I said, well, now, what about the keys? And, of course, there weren't any keys. So he got stuck again. very pleasant. We stayed in... Anyway, I learned the reason I mention this is because I think it influenced me considerably in what I had to do in Hong Kong later, in the way of keeping records of things, you see, which became terribly important, or at least I thought it did. Anyway, I learned a lot from Sandy Robb, and I'm eternally grateful to him. He's dead now, but when we got back after the war, I corresponded with him. He'd retired, and I still hear from his widow, which is very pleasant. We became great friends. Oh, yes, I was a captain in Jamaica. Went down as a captain. Although I was qualified as a major, there were no vacancies in the establishment for majors. And as a captain, in the eyes of Colonel Robb, I couldn't possibly know anything. Captains never did know anything, you see. But then one day, my majority came through. And we had a celebration, of course, and I turned up next day for work as a major. And suddenly I knew everything I had to know. Just overnight, I'd become an acceptable part of the organization, and this is all right. Well, I figured this Jamaican bit was sort of a phony war, you know. Nobody was getting hurt, so I sent for my family, and my wife and my two children came down. We took a house in the outskirts of Kingston, and we spent a very happy war there until 41. And then we got shipped out and came back to Winnipeg. In the fall, I guess it would be November, October, in the middle of October sometime. Anyway, it was cold, and we had been in the tropics for quite a while, and it was bitterly cold, I thought, in Winnipeg. We got reorganized. I got rid of a number of the troops that we'd had in Jamaica who I'd got a chance to know them pretty well by this time, and these chaps were not really fit to go fighting anybody, and I dropped them, kept a lot of others. We were under strength then, and we took a lot of reinforcements from other regiments, the South Saskatchewan and so on. Fellows came in, and there were our reinforcements. We got pretty well up to strength, and off we went to for somewhere. It was a very deep, dark secret where we were going until actually after we got on the Awatea in Vancouver. And we landed up in Hong Kong. I think that when I got to Hong Kong, I was somewhat of an embarrassment to the senior medical officer there, another regular RAMC colonel, full colonel, by the name of Simpson, delightful chap also. But what to do with a medical major who was the disposition for the battle plan in Hong Kong was a rather peculiar one. The various infantry battalions were spread around the island in small groups. They were broken up. They weren't really fighting except at about company strength. And the ordinary arrangements for medical care in an army didn't really apply. So the local people had dreamed up an evacuation scheme, which should have been quite effective, really. And they had a great big motorized group that they called the Field Ambulance, the Field Ambulance Company of the Hong Kong Volunteer Defense Corps, and the regular RAMC officers and Canadian officers, medical officers and so on, were all part of this organization if they weren't working in the hospitals, which were scattered around the island, either the regular hospitals or the ad hoc hospitals, which were to be set up in the event of attack. But I was a major, and this was an embarrassment. But Simpson thought of something. He was having a bit of trouble, I think, in the Hong Kong ambulance. It was commanded by a wonderful fellow, Lindsay Ride, who was then professor of physiology at the University of Hong Kong. Subsequently, after the war, was knighted and became chancellor of the University of Hong Kong. Wonderful guy. He himself was a first-class man. But there was friction in the field ambulance in that some of the regular RAMC officers rather resented working under the command of what was, after all, a territorial officer, you see, a militiaman, Lindsay Ride. And there was trouble. But Simpson got the idea that I didn't belong to either of these cliques. And I was a major, and I had a pretty good background of soldiering by this time. So he asked me if I would become second in command of the field ambulance working with Lindsay Ryan. And thus I could serve as a buffer between the regulars and the volunteers, and, you know. Oh, I thought this was reasonable and, you know, didn't look good. If there's going to be much of a war anyway in Hong Kong. So this is what I did, and it landed, I think, on the end of November, 16th of November, I think, anyway. We had 3 weeks there. 16th of November, I think, we arrived in Hong Kong, and I supposed it'd be about the 20th or so that I became 2IC of the field ambulance, and we started off on maneuvers. I had a new tool to play with here, and I had to learn the country, and we were up in the new territories, swanning around and having a look at where we might have to fight. And indeed, this time we could see the Japanese, because we were right up on the border of the new territory. We could see the Japanese massing transport and so on the border. So we realized that things weren't all that good. We were called back, I guess, about the 6th of December, and we had a no group where we decided that we'd better get ready. And, of course, on the 8th of December, we got hit. 8th Hong Kong time. and there it was. Well, we had quite a war. Very quickly, I think it's important to remember, really, that the original battle plan for the defense of Hong Kong was it never was intended to hold Hong Kong indefinitely. We were to fight and fall back and hold the island for 90 days, at which time we would be evacuated from the south shore of the island by the British Navy. That's a fine plan, except the British Navy got sunk in Singapore, if you'll recall, quite early in the operation. They dropped a bomb through the spout of the Prince of Wales, and that was that. So that our fight and fall back was accelerated a bit. I think, you know, there's a lot of talk about the lack of transport that we had. I've never felt this made any difference, really, because we couldn't have used the transport. The Japs had complete air superiority. We couldn't move on those roads in daylight without getting blasted off them. Any moving we did on our feet or bellies or whatever, and taking the low points, not using the roads much. And certainly our lack of air superiority hurt us very badly, lack of any kind of air defense, really. However, we hung on to the new territories. Interesting, I think, that the attack, the land attack, through the new territories. We had fallen back, the Canadians had all fallen back onto the island to take up our defense positions on the island. But the Royal Scots, or Middlesex, and forgotten Royal Scots, I think, were having a little trouble on the mainland, and a company of Canadian grenadiers, were sent over to the mainland to try and relieve them, to reinforce them. So that these were the first Canadian troops, I think, involved in actually shooting in World War I, World War II. I think that's true. Anyway. I think it was, let me see, Baker Company, yeah, I think so. Anyway, of course, this lack of air really put a kebab in field ambulance plans, because we were depending on collecting wounded from their defense positions and moving them by motor transport to the hospitals that were set up around the island. And unfortunately, we couldn't move our motor transport. Every time we did, we got shelled or shot at. I won't go through it. Day by day account of the war, except to say again that the some of the lads put on a magnificent defense. They all did, but some of them particularly. I think the attack in Wang Ni Chong Gap, where Bob Phillips, with a handful of men, held off a tremendous force of Japanese coming through. They were all wounded, mostly dead. Phillips himself, with an eye out and so on, ran out of ammunition and held them up for 2 days. And finally they came storming through. All resistance, further resistance was impossible, and we're all set to slaughter everybody there was. They found out how few were left and what a scrap they'd made. One of the Japanese officers, Bob Phillips, has told me this, shook hands with them and said, "You're a very brave man." and so he was. Well, all right, we... the little unit I was with, which were field ambulance people at this time, we were getting pushed farther and farther and farther up the hill all the time on the mainland. We finally ended up in the War Memorial Hospital, right up on the peak, Victoria Peak, and War Memorial Hospital, and Colonel Ride, somehow or another, in the next couple of days, persuaded Japanese to give him a pass which would enable him to walk around the island trying to find wounded. And he and I set off in the morning, and we must have walked about 25 miles, I guess, that day. Being stopped by Japanese patrols every now and again, who'd wonder whether they ought to bayonet us then or what, and this pass seemed to work. However, we did see a lot of the evidence of the massacres that had taken place in the island at this time, and Ride, who subsequently escaped and became one of the leading figures in intelligence in the Far East, I guess was able to make good use of this. Anyway, we tramped around and we found a lot of dead. We didn't find any wounded living. This was a scary sort of business, but we survived it, and we got back. And then we were moved down, concentrated in the end of December, and we all moved over to the mainland on the 1st of January. And this is quite a trek. I figured, you know, that I was going to need all the medical supplies I could get, and I filled everything I had with whatever I could get in the way of instruments and drugs, such as good ones like sulfas and things like that. And I had my pockets stuffed with this and my haversack stuffed with it, so on, and off we went. And we walked from the Star Ferry that we were taken over on up to Sham Shui Po, which was the old camp where we'd actually been barracked. Well, this is quite a change. By this time, the Chinese had looted everything that had been in the camp. Plumbing was all torn out, and the glass was all gone from the windows, and the roofs were either ripped out or shot out, and it was a pretty scraggly place. Now, this camp had been designed to hold two battalions, a couple of thousand people. We had the whole garrison in there. We must have had 10,000, I guess, in this very primitive stuff. And, of course, we didn't have anything to eat, and we didn't have any sanitary facilities, and then we were getting into trouble. And this was we ad hoc the hospital there. We took the officer's mess building, and I got some sacking, and we covered it. Damn cold in December, January. Covered the gaping windows with this, and we plugged up the pipes where they torn the fixtures out. They were spouting water, flooding everything, so we got that. Cleaned it up with scrapers and so on as best we could. There was a billiard table in the officer's mess, the only sort of solid thing that was left, and I turned this into an operating table, and we began patching up the troops as best we could under pretty primitive conditions. Well, we were in Sham Shui Po, I guess, for 3 or 4 months, forgotten just how long. And then they moved all the Canadians back to the mainland, back to North Point Camp, which had been a refugee camp on the North Shore, just at the Limoon Gap. I think physical conditions were maybe a little better there. Destruction wasn't quite so great. Anyway, we were there for a year. And, of course, this is the time that, during this time, that our first introduction, dysentery, we always had, from the beginning, we had dysentery of some kind or another. But it was at this period that we got our first manifestations of this peculiar neurological thing, which we didn't know what it was, but it was obviously concurrent with, if not due to, a nutritional deficiency, or we thought it was a vitamin D deficiency, and indeed I'm not sure that it wasn't. But it could have been toxic, and it's very interesting to note that just now the Japanese are reporting in the Lancet and the British Medical Journal what they call subacute myelo-optical neuropathy in epidemic proportions in some of the small cities in Japan. And this is the syndrome that we had in Hong Kong, or at least part of the syndrome. Anyway, this is where it started. And then we got diphtheria while we were still in North Point. Now, while we were in North Point, I could do something about it. We had no anti-serum. The only hope we had was sort of isolation, but I was in contact with Bowen Road Hospital, a British military hospital, which wasn't very far away from us as long as we were in North Point. And I could get rid of my diphtheria cases out of the camp and send them up to the hospital. To this extent, I had some quarantine control, though it was pretty inefficient. But anyway, there it was. But then they moved us over back to Sam Shui Po, and this was a bad show because we had a lot of sick and a lot of diphtheria cases, well, half a dozen of them at that time, that we took over in the ferry with us. So we introduced this beautifully into Sam Shui Po, and it just ran like wildfire. God, I had a hell of a time with diphtheria. And here again. Well, it's easy under civilized circumstances. You shoot somebody full of diphtheria antiserum, 40,000 units, and they're all right, better. I didn't have any antiserum. I'm probably one of the few people who have seen, in this day and age, who have seen people run through diphtheria from initial infection to death with no treatment. I got pretty bitter about this because I knew there was antiserum in the island. I knew it was in some of the go-downs, and the Japs just wouldn't let me have it at all. I want to say here what I've said many times before, that some of my lads, we tried to get our diphtheria cases in a special hospital, which we made in the Jubilee building in Sam Shui Po. And these lads volunteered to be nursing orderlies for their mates that were terribly ill, and many of them going to die. Now, these lads volunteered. They knew that this sort of exposure would almost certainly they become infected. They knew that if they became infected, they stood a very good chance of dying. And still, they volunteered. And I taught them a little bit about nursing orderlies' work, enough to get by on. And they did a magnificent job. And I think that this is real courage, real, cold, raw courage. And they were great. Anyway, tremendously proud of them. And some of them did get diphtheria, and some of them maybe died, But
everywhere. Do you remember how many lost with the diphtheria?
Hmm?
Do you remember how many men you lost in the diphtheria?
Oh, I don't know. 108, I think. But I've got a record of it somewhere.
Doesn't matter. I just
want
a rough
idea. Yeah. Finally, the Japs did bring us in a little bit of serum. This presented us with a problem because all we were going to do really was to give it to people to save life. Well, we thought they might get paralyzed, but if we could keep them alive, and instead of the 40,000 unit doses that we wanted to use, we were using 50 or 100 units, you know, just homeopathic doses. But it did keep them alive. Death stopped and so on. But the decision who was going to get this and who wasn't was a pretty tough one. We had a conference, all the medical people, and we came to the conclusion that we would give it to people who had membrane, that was, you know, diphtheria starts with this, for less than 24 hours. Anybody who'd had it longer than that wouldn't get any serum. So this was a pretty, you know, sort of decision that only God should have to make. But I think it was a wise one, and the people that we did give it to lived as a result of this, because we were getting it as early as possible. Well, by this time, of course, we had a beautiful bag in our hands, which was the nutritional deficiency, which we were by this time calling avitaminosis, which doesn't really mean anything except indicates nutritional deficiency, and the post-diphtheritic syndrome, and the dysentery. It was a hell of a thing, and October 43, I guess. Really, we reached the trough. We had in the whole camp, we had some 15 deaths in one day. Looked pretty bad. And then we did get a bulk shipment of Red Cross supplies of bully beef and so on. We never thought we'd get another one. How to use this. Should we stuff everybody full or ration it out for how long? You know, question. But we did ration it out, and indeed, not too badly. We ran out again, but we never again got into this terrible death rate and so on. We had a few deaths later. Harry Hook, for example, died. Very good and old friend, just really before we got sprung. A hell of a lot of funny things happened in camp too, as well as this very grim stuff.
What type of equipment did you have?
Medical equipment?
Yes.
Oh. Well, as I say, I'd taken over a few forceps and scalpels and things and what I could carry in my pockets. The boys were very ingenious. We were fortunate in having with us, in addition to our own Canadian people, we had some British engineer types, Remy types, and they made a lot of stuff for me. For example, somebody found a straight razor with a great gouge out of it. The boys in the work parties used to bring me back anything they thought I could use. You know, they're terribly good about this. And one of these Brit fellows sat down for hours and hours and hours on a stone, grinding this until he got it into some sort of usable shape, you know. They made me an operating room table that was adjustable to a couple of positions. You could tilt it a bit, you know. If I had to do any belly work, you could tilt them. They made me an operating room light that burned peanut oil, 24 peanut oil power, 24 wick power light, with reflectors that, you know, concentrated this bit of light on the operating room table. They made me an eye chart, because I was terribly interested in what was going on, you know, in these eyes that we couldn't see, but we felt it must be something. I wanted to do visual acuities and didn't have a Snellen's chart and didn't know the mathematics involved in making an eye chart. Mm-hmm. Until finally I got I found out that this was the size of this was the size of the height was the height that subtended an angle of 1 degree at a distance of 20 feet. But then I didn't have any trigonometry. I didn't know. But I had lots of guys that were mathematicians and did know. And they worked it out. And they made me a Snellen's chart using black Chinese ink on white paper. And I did all these eye tests with this eye chart that they made me. They made me a dingus, too, that I found in a book somewhere what it was all about, how to measure peripheral vision, because obviously one of the things we were having was knocking out peripheral vision. And they made me one of these apparatuses, a perimeter, it's called, and you move a target in, and it's fixed in the column scene. They made me this. Pretty ad hoc sort of stuff, but this is it. Now, of course, what I missed more than anything else were a few important drugs. I wanted vitamin B. I wanted, gallon lots, and I didn't have any. I wanted sulfur drugs. You see, we didn't know anything about penicillin. This was developed later. But sulfur, sulfapyridine, sulfonamide, and so on, we knew about, and they were specific for our dysentery. If I could get that, we were in business. And I didn't have much of that. And quinine or something for our malaria. These were the things I really needed and didn't have. And, I'd put in indents to the Japanese requests for these drugs, and they'd send me a couple of gallons of Lysol. You know, if you kept everything clean, then you wouldn't have any disease. Oh, Nips had some brilliant ideas about sanitation. We had dysentery, and then Nips said, well, you should have quarantine. I said, yes, of course we should, and we had them in a separate dysentery hospital. And they put a fence around this, one strand of barbed wire. This was when we got the diphtheria. They put a fence around that, but they put two strands of barbed wire because that was worse. A very odd people, the Nips.
Did they ever try to help you at all, or were they had the attitude of sort of blocking you?
I think. Well, now we have to qualify this, of course, but in general, the official position, I think, was one of complete indifference. They didn't give a damn. Mm-hmm. I think they hoped we'd all die because we were an embarrassment to them, you know. As long as they were winning in Southeast Asia, they weren't going to be responsible to anybody. They just were indifferent. Now, there are some exceptions. One little man who was people told me he was a Lutheran priest. He was Japanese. His name was Watanabe. And he was an interpreter. At any rate, he was a very good man. And he took some awful chances on smuggling stuff into me in the way of drugs and things, you know, what he could lay his hands on. They'd have executed him like crazy, you know.
Did you have general anesthesia?
I had chloroform that I'd brought back in my pocket. And it's the world's worst anesthetic. It's one of the earliest ones. But by God, it's useful under these conditions because it doesn't evaporate very fast, and
it's better than nothing.
Oh yeah, better than nothing. I don't think I killed anybody with chloroform, though I may have.
How about Bowen Road Hospital? How did they?
Bowen Road was not. You see, they weren't bothered as much, really. They were a hospital. They had medical stores. If I could get people up to Bowen Road, I was pretty happy. But the communication stopped when we went over to North Point, except about once a month they'd let me ship people over. By then they were either dead or better, you know. My interest, my problem mainly was in ad hoc-ing some kind of treatment with nothing to work with in the prison camp itself.
I suppose you had become very inventive.
Yeah, inventive. I guess, excuse me, I'm sorry. Is that... I was an absolute quack. Really. I knew I couldn't do very much, but I couldn't afford to let the troops know I knew I couldn't do very much. I had to convince them that everything is fine. So, boy, I was practicing Christian Science, to beat the band. Well, yeah, talking them out of it, really.
Yeah.
It's about to.
What could you do for Gary Berry when they have the seat? What was your general?
Well, I couldn't do anything with the seat. We had a little bit of. We got a little bit of. Vitamin B, a fellow named Selwyn Clark who was the civilian chief medical officer in the civilian side for a while, was loose around the island, and he smuggled me in a player's flat 50 tin full of thiamin one time, pushed it through the wire. So we had a little. We had to use all this very sparingly. Well, my main thing was with these poor devils that had this paresthesia of the feet, this terrible, like, shooting pain in the feet. God awful. And if they could keep them cold, it wasn't quite so painful. So they used to soak them in cold water. They'd sit with their feet in cold water, and this gave them some relief. But it also softened the skin, macerated the skin, so that they got infection on top of this. And then I had gangrene and sure death. So I used to bully them and batter them and so on, about soaking their feet, and they couldn't do it. And I'd go around in the middle of the night, around the latrines where they'd be sitting. If they had their feet on the cold tile floor, this was all right. But if they had them in soaking in the water, I remember jerking one poor lad out, giving him hell about this. And later they said to him, the M.O. came around and he pulled them out like a cork out of a bottle. But it had to be pretty firm. Still, your heart was breaking because you couldn't do anything about it. I couldn't do anything about it. Really. But maybe I could prevent it from getting worse, which was really all I was trying to do.
Did you get a special ration for
it? No. No, as a matter of fact, Japanese rationed, so much came in for men that were at work, and anybody that wasn't at work got a reduced ration. Now, we never paid any attention to this. We got in the supplies and divided them, and everybody got the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
But this was the Japanese calculation. If you weren't working, you didn't eat. No, they wanted us to die, and
mm-hmm.
they did their best to see that we did. And we, indeed, we definitely did. It was, I think when we got sprung in 45, we were really pretty close to the end of our tether. The tremendous death rate of 43, 44 had stopped. We'd evened out as a result of this Red Cross shipment. It stopped a lot of our problem. We didn't have any deaths for a while, but they were just starting again. We were out of supplies. We were again on starvation rations, and the death rate was just starting again in the summer of 1945. So I think if it had gone on for very much longer, none of us would have made it.
How about the Japanese personnel in the camp? Were they had difficulty with rations for their own men?
Well, I don't know. They all looked pretty fat and sassy. I think, a lot of the camp staff ate a hell of a lot of our stuff, you know. They had their fingers into that. I think they ate all right. They lived off the country pretty well. They had all the new territories to rob.
They plundered.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Do you remember the work drafts
to
Japan?
Oh, God, yeah. Well, the work drafts to Japan, yes. So we had two Canadian drafts. That was their method of selection was very good. They lined us all up, parade ground, said, now take 5 steps forward. Anybody that took 5 steps forward was fit enough to go on the draft, you know. If they could walk 5 steps, they could walk to Tokyo. And halt, and the lame and the blind. It worked down. I had to decide who simply could not go on a work draft. There's two work parties around the camp. All the troops were sick, terribly sick. And Japs were insisting that, so many work party of 150 or whatever would go out. And I'd have a sick parade in the morning. Sick parade, and boys would come and say, sir, I can't go on work party. And I'd say, no, I know, Tom, you can't. You're too sick. Well, I'll have to send Jim. He'd say, Christ, sir, you can't do that. Jim's sicker than I am. And I'd say, one has to go. He'd say, all right, I'll go. they were good. They were good. And great bunch. Great bunch, fella.
Do you remember
the escape attempt? Well, yeah, this took place at North Point. These four lads actually went over the roof of the warehouse that I was using as a hospital at this time, which got me into a little bit of trouble with the Japanese authorities because they were sure I had aided and abetted this. So happened I wasn't aware of the fact they were going, these lads. If they had, I If I had, I think I would have helped them. But I didn't know. Four of them went. As far as I know, they were executed. I don't know what they were caught. Right, in January of 42, he knew the country like the back of his hand, and he had a lot of Chinese friends. He decided he'd escape from Sham Shui Po. He offered me the chance of going with him. I didn't take it for several reasons. I think, first of all, I was pretty sure I'd jeopardize his chances because pretty hard for me to pretend that I was Chinese in my build. And secondly, I really felt that I had a duty to stay with my troops and I might be able to help them because nobody else was going to be able to much. And thirdly, of course, I was damn scared. I mean, it's better the devil you know than the one you don't. Anyway, Ride did get through. It was very harrowing experiences, and sent a cable to my wife here in Canada, which caused great consternation because it cable from Chongqing, where he got up to Chongqing, and all it said was, "Husband alive and well, Ride." She didn't know who Ride was. She was a local chap. Oh, there was great kerfuffle, but finally they decided it was a real thing. So she knew that I was still alive earlier than most of the Canadian wives knew about their husband, because communications were just non-existent, you know. Years, nothing happened. But she knew this.
Did he successfully escape?
Oh, yes, indeed, he successfully escaped. He got up to Chongqing, they flew him down to India, and within about 3 months, he was back in the Hong Kong area, intelligence. And he was around that part of the world all during the war, and one of the first fellows I saw when we got sprung in 45 was Luke Wright.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
You're the first person to tell me about him.
Yeah, well, the others didn't know him as well. I knew him very well, you see. I've seen him several times since.
How did you get along with Camp Commandant? Did you have some really good run-ins with him?
He's a thoroughgoing bastard.
Yeah.
Oh, yes, we all had problems with him. And, of course, I had my problems, too, with the Japanese medical officer in charge, who was also a very bad hat. A fellow by the name of Saito. I had the pleasure, well, pleasure's not right because it wasn't pleasant, but they took me back to Hong Kong in 46 on the war trials, you know, and Saito was in the dock, and I was very glad to see him there, along with Tokunaga, the camp commandant. All that era. They were bad hats, most unpleasant.
Did he seem to buck you when you wanted supplies or how about Saito? What did he say about him? Was he at all interested in the medical aspect?
Not really. No. No. When we had, I think, four or five diphtheria deaths one day, at the height of the epidemic in Canadians, he called all these volunteer orderlies of mine out, you know, and gave them a lecture, which he accused them. Their comrades were dying because they were not doing their best, and he told them to... anyone who was doing his best, don't step forward and he cut his head off. And a fellow named Varley stepped forward. I was protesting, you know. So, Riley came up to me, shook hands, said, "Goodbye, sir. It's been nice knowing him." And off he went. And I thought, because I thought they would execute him. And a short time later, Varley appeared. He said, "What the hell happened to you?" And he said, "Well," he said, "they took me around behind the hut." And the sergeant said, "You're a brave man." And that was the end of that.
They're funny to forget.
Oh, impossible. They'd come into the hut swinging these damn swords of theirs, you know, and they just were having fun, a little drunk. But they'd be swinging these things around. You never knew whether they were going to get chopped or not.
Now, did you didn't get food drops, did you know? You always stayed in Hong Kong.
Oh, yeah, we had a food drop at the very end, after, in August 45. They dropped me enough medical supplies to last me for about 6 years, I figured. Right, I was going. I didn't plan on staying that long. Mm-hmm.
And then the boat came.
Oh, yes. Boat came. Didn't ever anybody tell you about how that His Majesty's colony of Hong Kong was recaptured?
No.
Well, we had the senior officer in camp was a British officer, Middlesex, by the name of Simon White. And we had heard from really an unimpeachable source outside that the war was over. And before I say this, we had got through one of the Chinese newspapers. The speech had been made, Truman had made the speech about dropping the atomic bomb on the radio. This had been picked up by the Japanese monitors, but devastation had been done, but the atomic bomb translated into the Chinese newspapers, picked up by us, retranslated into English, and it came out atomic bomb. And, you know, wonderful. Anyway, we didn't know what an atomic bomb was, although, you know, you could imagine it had something to do with atomic fission. Well, we got this from a very reliable source outside. And we were on parade the next day, and Simon White, a little subaltern Japanese, was doing the nose count. Simon White said, "We understand that the war is over. And if it is, I want to discuss with Colonel Tokunaga the administrative arrangements which must be made." And parade, and all those bloody machine guns, you know, pointing at it. Well, the little Nep was greatly upset and flustered, but he did say, "Oh, no, the war isn't over. There may be a ceasefire, temporary ceasefire." And off he went, and he was terribly upset that we knew anything about it. And, well, Simon White called his senior officers, including me, to a conference in his room as to, you know, how we could manage. And while we were there, a runner came down. "Colonel Tokunaga wishes to see Colonel Simon White in his office at once." And Simon White said, "Oh, no. If Colonel Tokunaga wishes to see me to discuss the subject I mentioned this morning on parade, he will come to my office. And Tokunaga came. So all the bluster in the world, you know, didn't wash this out. But I thought, oh my God, here we go again, you know. But Simon Whitefoot, just a gutsy little guy, and it's the way he played it. Did decide, you know, we did come to some sort of arrangement about division of territory. We would look after ourselves, and we made contracts with the local compradors about feeding us and so on. And the town was divided. The Japs kept their distance. We patrolled our own wire to keep the Chinese from looting us as much as anything. This was the great bed leg patrol. We had no weapons, so we took the metal legs off the barrack beds and protected ourselves with these. But we also felt that we had to reestablish His Majesty's government in Hong Kong. So we sprung out of Stanley Prison, or Stanley Camp, a little third secretary or something, who was the only civil servant left, colonial civil servant around, and we made him acting governor, and we set up a military government in Hong Kong. And when the Navy finally did arrive, senior captain coming off the ship, he was met by Simon White, who saluted and said, "Sir, I have great pleasure in handing back to you His Majesty's colony of Hong Kong. We lost it. It's only right that we should give it back." Those were great days. I got a hell of a scare about that time. All the Chinese who had been collaborating with the Japanese in the colony now wanted to collaborate with us again. They wanted back into favor. And they brought all kinds of things into camp, including liquor. And some of it, in the typical Chinese fashion, wasn't very good liquor. It had, been tampered with a bit. I was sitting in my room one night, and I got a call that one of the Canadian officers was desperately ill. And I went over to see him, and God, he was ill. He was vomiting, he had diarrhea, he had algae, had collapsed. And there was cholera all around us, and we had never had cholera in the camp. And here the war was over, and we were waiting to go home. And I thought I had a case of cholera. And what the hell was I going to do with that, Was I going to quarantine everybody? Keep everybody from going home? God. Well, I was never so relieved in my life. I sat with this guy all night pumping stuff into his veins from the drop that we'd had by this time. I had lots of things to work with. It was a joy to see anybody sick because I could do something. And realized, finally, what had happened. He'd just been poisoned with bad booze. And he didn't have cholera. I was so happy about that. But that gave me a terrible scare.
When he was before he started to get well fed, did you
Oh, not really surprised. No, I some of them overdid it a bit, got grossly fat and an unhealthy sort of fat too, because a good deal of it was wet. We all went down from Hong Kong to Manila. I think the Empress of Scotland, Empress or something, anyway, trooping. We got into camp there, and then we persuaded the Yanks that it would be much better if they took us home rather than going around the world with the Brits, you know. And they agreed to do this. I went, I guess, on the first draft out of Manila. The military authorities here wanted to question some of us, you know, and find out. So I was one of the early drafts home. And that was quite a trip. We were in the Admiral Rodney, I think it was one of these American Liberty ships, with, you know, we were all jammed into a cabin, about 12 of us, with no lights, electric lights going all the time, but no outside light, trooper. So you never knew what time of day it was. I had no watch. But it didn't matter, because the cafeteria was open 24 hours a day, and you could get anything you wanted, and as much of it as you wanted. You could have breakfast at 11 o'clock at night if you woke up and felt like having breakfast. But there, too, if you didn't want breakfast, you could have full-course dinner, you see. It was all that, the whole thing. Oh, they fed us well. And then we got home. And,
how many men came out of that camp alive?
Canadians?
Yes.
1,400.
Stanley Camp, that was where...
Stanley was where the civilians were. And my two nursing sisters were there, too.
How did they make out in
Stanley? Well, I don't think they had as rugged a time as we did. I don't think they... It wasn't any Hilton Hotel, you know. I don't think they had as many deaths as we did. I don't know.
I heard a rumor that some of the officers after the war were taken somewhere else. Was it to a hotel or what was it? Some of the officers?
Canadians?
Yes. Or was it to England?
Well, it depends what time we're talking about. Just after the war, a lot of the officers who were caught on the east end of the island were put into a camp on Argyle Street. Now the others, like us. Like I was on the west end of the island, place cut in half. Never did get to Argyle Street. We went into North Point, and then the Argyle Street bunch joined us a week later, maybe. No Canadians, or at least only one Canadian officer, left Hong Kong. And that was Jack Reed, who went up with one of the Canadian labor drafts. They wanted a medical officer. Jack went up to Japan. He was the only Canadian officer in Japan. The others were all the other Canadian officers were left with the Canadian troops in Hong Kong.
And there were two drafts left for Japan. How many men then per draft were there, roughly?
Oh, 700. I'm guessing now. I have this down, but something like that. Oh, it couldn't have been. Couldn't have been that many, because there were two drafts. It'd be about 700 in all, I guess, about 300.
And in your experience, after Lodge afterwards, was there any difference from the boys went to Japan compared to the ones that stayed in Hong Kong? Were they healthier or worse?
Not really. No.
Not much.
No. They had a hell of a time, too. Yokohama and the dockyards and so on, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The difference, I think, is that, yeah, maybe they were a little better because they were selected as the most physically fit. That's why they went to Japan on work party. Now, this was out of a pretty scurvy lot by this time, but they nevertheless were the best of the lot. And so thus, they were in maybe better shape, the Japanese lot, when we got home. because they were starting from a little higher level. That's all.
How did you find them, your treatment of the men when they got back? They were brought into Deer Lodge, eh? This is where you worked after that?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, we were all sent on leave, of course, and then all called back for examination. The sick ones, of course, went to Deer Lodge. We were all screened in a sort of way, and Gordon had in the West Coast before we ever did come back to Winnipeg. But once in Winnipeg, we used Deer Lodge as a base. The sick were admitted. The others were called back and handled on an outpatient basis. And we were on leave for I don't know how long, months. With double ration, everybody on coupons, you know, in those days, and we all had double ration coupons, two of everything. And I'd see the lights, I mean, regular periods, and in Deer Lodge. I don't know how long it took to get rid of the last of them from the army and turn them into civilians again.
Well,
years.
What was the most common sickness you felt they were left with? Do you think it was this eye condition?
Well, the sequel of the no doubt about it. What I don't think that the diphtheria had any long-lasting effects. You were either dead or you got better. Now, a lot of them were paralyzed for quite a long time, but they did recover. The dysentery, by and large, didn't have any effects. It was a bacillary dysentery. It was not an amoebic dysentery. We may have had a few cases of amoebic, and they have continuing trouble, but the dysentery, by and large, is not a problem. But this other thing was, what has happened, you see, is that there is a demyelination of the spinal cord. Now, this means that the insulation of the sort of the nerve tracts in the spinal cord is gone. And they get short-circuited, in very popular terms. This is the only way I can describe it. This is a patchy thing. It's not all over, but it's patchy. And depending how many of these patches you're left with, and where they are in the spinal cord, you have symptoms in varying degree. Now, some people have practically nothing to show for. I am lucky in that what I have left is not terribly disabling. But a lot of these other fellows who had big patches of this pathology are in real trouble. And there it is.
Many of them are left very nervous. I've met several, and they're very nervous.
Yeah. Well, you know, if you live scared for 4 years, you're bound to be a little nervous.
Well, I think that's everything.